This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School Public Safety Commission released its initial findings report to state authorities this week. After last February's shooting that left 17 dead, members of the commission sought input from the community and investigated how first responders and school officials handled the shooting. Recommendations to try and prevent another school shooting include beefing up security and surveillance and arming school staff. So what does the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School Public Safety Commission report mean for students and staff at schools statewide? If you have kids in school, how do you feel about the idea of tighter security or more armed staff watching over your kids? And what about code red drills to prepare for an active shooting? Are there other things that would make schools safer for students and teachers? You can reach out to us at 1866 338 5252 with your questions and comments. Send us a tweet. We're at WMFE Orlando. Well, I'm joined today by WLRN reporter Katie Switalski. Katie, thanks so much for being here.
Hi, Matthew. Thanks.
I'm also joined by Seminole County Sheriff Dennis Lima. Sheriff Lima, thank you so much as well.
Thank you for having me.
And with us in the studio, former police officer, now security expert who specializes in active threat training, Zach Hudson. Zach, thank you as well.
Thank you, sir.
Katie, I want to start with you. You've taken a look at this pretty lengthy report. What's it recommending to state authorities to try and keep students safe down the track?
So there's 16 chapters of this report. It's over 400 pages, but it breaks down a couple of the main categories. There's, of course, like you mentioned, school hardening, and that includes things like how can we make our classrooms and school grounds physically safer, mm-hmm. things like updating fences, locks, and ways to get in and out of a school. The report's recommending that every school in Florida go to this single point of entry. So there's really one way in and one way out. Mm-hmm. And that's to try to mitigate who can get in at all times. The report also asks that classrooms all have what's called hard corners. And that's a spot in the classroom where it's kind of taped off by bookshelves or something else so that students can hide behind it and not be seen by someone looking into the classroom in a code red situation. But then the report goes into a lot of policies. And these could be policies that are already in place but are not effective. And the commission is looking at code red policies as something that is just not uniform across the state at all and needs to be uniform. Or it could be creating new policies, like redefining how sheriff's offices look at active assailant situations.
Mm-hmm. Katie Switalski, the idea of kind of hard corners, more security and everything, I mean, that's something that's been talked about probably before this report came out. But does the report also delve into quite a lot of detail about what exactly happened at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School? And what's your sense from your understanding of it, of kind of where that school and that school district fits within the broader scope of things? Like, was Marjorie Stoneman Douglas an anomaly, or did you get the sense from what the folks on that commission have found that it's just kind of typical of the way schools run in Florida?
Absolutely. I think so the commission interviewed hundreds and hundreds of teachers and school personnel for this report. And what they found and what the report is alleging is that this widespread confusion that happened at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas is not just an anomaly, that it is happening at other schools, other school districts across the state. And so the report breaks down, I mean, second by second, what happens that day at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. And it finds that a lot of, you know, teachers, a lot of higher-ups at the school weren't aware or weren't trained properly on things like code red policies, when to call a code red, how to call a code red. And that just isn't an anomaly at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. It's pretty widespread.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking about the notion of school security, school safety, how to make things safer, and what the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School Public Safety Commission has found and their recommendations, which are heading to Tallahassee. I want to hear from you as well. You can reach out to us at 1-866-338-5252 or send us a tweet. We're at WMFE Orlando. What's your understanding, if you have kids at school, what's your understanding of how they run code red drills or what kind of security there is? Do you have concerns? And from what you've heard about what's come out of this commission, do you think they're on the right track? Or is Florida on the right track of making things safer so we can prevent a school shooting down the track? We're at 1-866-338-5252. and you can reach out to us on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. Zach Hudson, I want to bring you into this conversation. Talking about Code Red rules, as Katie Swetelski was mentioning, just kind of back us up a little bit and explain what those are.
Code Red really focuses on lockdown or lockout, depending upon where you're at in the country. You want to be able to initiate a lockdown or a Code Red so that everyone has an appropriate response to an active threat incident.
Mm-hmm. And from what you've seen in your time sort of training folks in how to deal with active threat training, does it sort of tally with what your understanding is of what's in that report, which is that is a patchwork of systems across the state and schools aren't necessarily all on the same page?
Well, I mean, schools want to educate folks, right? They want to educate their kids. They don't want to be training in security-related items or security-related fields. But the truth is, where we're at as a society, this is a major problem. It's happening all the time. And teachers, administrators, everyone that works in a school should play a part in their security plan and should know what their responses should be when they go on Code Red.
Mm-hmm. Is it harder to do at a bigger school?
Sure it is. Yeah, the larger the school, the more complicated that becomes. Exits are always going to be a major issue. It is definitely a very complex problem.
Mm-hmm. And whose responsibility is it? I mean, a lot of schools, like if you look at Orange County, where the studio is based, for example, there are deputies, school resource officers in those schools. Is it their responsibility to try and sort of take charge of what happens as far as training goes, or is it the school principal? Who should be in charge of this?
Well, I think when you talk about responsibility, I think it really falls on everyone on site. It shouldn't just be the responsible of a single law enforcement officer to try to protect this 250,000 square foot facility. It has to be everybody. Mm-hmm. Everybody should be involved in that training, in that response. And basically, each teacher, each cafeteria worker, no matter who they are, all of them should know what their roles are and what their responses should be.
I want to bring Sheriff Dennis Lima into this conversation with Seminole County. Now, just thinking about this report, I mean, the timeline, the blow-by-blow of what happened in South Florida in Parkland last year, it shows the gap in time where the Broward County Sheriff's offices should have responded. And there's been some criticism, of course, leveled at the sheriff in that county, Scott Israel, over the active shooter policy. Sheriff Lima, though, let me ask you, Seminole County has had a policy which says deputies must engage active shooters. Can you just explain what that policy is and how it works in practice?
Yeah, the policy seems rather obvious, as the good guys have to engage the bad guys as quickly as possible. And, you know, reading the report, we weren't surprised with any of the recommendations that came out of the report at all. And quite frankly, you know, after Columbine and these recent active shooter and active killer situations, it's kind of a shift that we made a long time ago. Mm-hmm. It starts with making sure that you hire dedicated, professionally trained law enforcement officers that want to be on the campus to provide safety and security, and then a whole lot more. They want to mentor and they want to groom, but they want to look for those clues and they want to interact with the kids and the faculty and staff and the parents. Our deputies are trained and taught to engage an active threat immediately. Backup will come within the next couple of minutes, but we want to make sure that they're properly trained, properly equipped, and prepared to do the job of saving lives.
And when you talk about sort of being aware and able to identify threats, it seems like this didn't really happen in the case of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, but how do you, like, if you're a single resource officer in a pretty big school, how do you get to know all those kids? How do you sort of make sure that you have the time to be able to identify those threats if there is a threat down the track?
Yeah, honestly, it's not that difficult. In the case of many of these active killers, there have been telltale signs of dysfunction somewhere along the path, whether it's discipline problems. You know, I'm absolutely convinced that crime and delinquency and delinquent behavior starts with a simple thought. And unfortunately, there's nobody that I've ever met that can predict what somebody else is thinking. The first time we see it is when they demonstrate it with their behavior, the attitude and prior history of involvement with law enforcement. You look at most of these active killer situations, the people who are targeting the campuses and acting out their violence on campus have a direct association. Either they come from the student body or they're inside the school. You know, if you look at, you know, a high school campus, you may have 2,000 or 3,000 people, but when you look at the law enforcement officers that are present embedded within those communities day in and day out, it's really not that challenging when you look at our patrol deputies in a decentralized policing concept are patrolling communities with, you know, 50,000, 60,000 people. Mm-hmm. It's being engaged, talking to the kids, talking to the faculty and staff, being in tune with school discipline reports, and when you see something, say something, be a resource for everyone else.
What about the notion, which has been a bit controversial, of arming school staff? Where do you stand on that, Sheriff Lima?
Well, I'm very fortunate here in Seminole County that we don't have to do that. I think that in an ideal situation, every jurisdiction should be well-equipped and prepared to put a dedicated, professionally trained law enforcement officer on each one of these campuses to handle those things. Mm-hmm. It's really more than a shoot-don't-shoot situation. I mean, there's varying levels of forces and degrees that need to be taken into consideration. And the law enforcement officer's presence on the campus extends well beyond safety. I mean, we're teaching curriculums on the campus. Our school resource deputies on all of our schools are playing a part of the faculty and staff as well. And I'm proud to say that 3 years ago, we put a dedicated school resource deputy or officer on every single public school campus in Seminole County, which is nearly 70 campuses. You know, here this year, we added two deputies to every high school and a deputy sheriff for every charter school. Mm-hmm. But I do understand that some jurisdictions that cannot afford to do that or had not had the means or the ability to do that, they have to do something. So arming dedicated, you know, the rumor is it's school teachers. It's not school teachers. It's faculty members that do that. Mm-hmm. So I do understand that for some jurisdictions, that may be an option for them. For us, it's dedicated law enforcement officers.
Right, and like I said, it varies county to county. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're talking about school safety, reactions to the initial report from the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School Public Safety Commission, and recommendations on how to make schools safer and prevent another school shooting down the track. I want to hear from you, 1-866-338-5252. What are your thoughts about school safety? If you have kids at school, are you concerned kind of hearing about some of these recommendations? Do you think they're on the right track? And what's your understanding of the way safety procedures and protocols are carried out now? We're at 1-866-338-5252. You can reach out to us on Twitter as well. We're at WMFE Orlando. Katie Swetelski, let me bring you back into this conversation. Reading through that report and sort of listening to what some of the people on that commission had to say, do you get the sense that there's real kind of cohesion there, or there's some people who are sort of sounding the alarm about some of those things, like, for example, the idea of more firearms on campus, even if they're carried by people who are trained and presumably know how to use them?
There's definitely tension on that commission. It's made up of mostly law enforcement officers and sheriffs, mm-hmm. One state senator, and some victims' family members. So the way that those groups are working together has not always been smooth. This report did come together really, really fast, if you think about it. I mean, it was put together in about 8 months, and it is what a lot of people are considering a good first start, but it's by no means going to be the commission's only report or the only topics that they cover. So when it came to voting on, you know, whether some trained teachers should be able to carry firearms on campuses, the entire commission minus one person voted for this. The big things I think they're really cohesive on, but it's the little things along the way. It's not been a smooth road, mm-hmm. at all.
What about community reaction too, in the broader community? Are people, because obviously we're just a couple months away, I guess, from the anniversary of this the tragedy at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. So these events are still pretty fresh in the minds of folks there. What are people kind of? What's the response been to your understanding of what this report's recommendations have been?
It's such a big report. I think people are focusing, obviously, on some of the bigger issues, like the fact that teachers are being recommended to carry firearms. Mm-hmm. That's pretty controversial here. But I think what I've heard from family members, parents, and people whose schools are starting to look at some of these procedures. I mean, we knew that the recommendations were coming for a few months. The commission hasn't been, you know, secretive or hiding these recommendations. It's just that now they're official.
Mm-hmm.
And I think advocates of hardening schools instead of gun control are very happy with this report. The people who advocated from day one after the shooting that we needed to update single point of entry and change the way schools physically look,
mm-hmm.
They're very pleased. Now, and there are some victims' families and particularly one father on this commission that have stood up and said, hey, okay, it doesn't address gun control at all. You know, we hope the commission addresses gun control in the future. And it's been really disheartening for the March for Our Lives students, this huge wave of student activism we saw right after the shooting. You know, those students have been fighting for gun control measures of any kind since this happened. And to see this report not address that in any way definitely is a disappointment to those kids.
I'm going to go to the phones now. We've got Eric on the line. Eric, what are your thoughts listening to this conversation?
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm listening to the conversation, and I'm hearing about hardening and what happens when the shooting is occurring. What I'm not hearing about, and what I'd like to hear more about, is how the school knew that this student was dangerous. There were multiple warning signs that were ignored, and no one did anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'd like to hear about.
Eric, thanks for your call. Katie, what are your thoughts there? I mean, what's in the report that sort of details what happened there and maybe why action wasn't taken quicker?
Yeah, to address Eric's question, there is a chapter in the report that talks about behavioral threat assessment teams. And so right after the shooting happened at Marjory Stoneman Douglas, the legislature passed the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School Public Safety Act. And that big bill, which created this commission, also mandated that schools had to have these threat assessment teams. And what the commission has found, almost a year later, is that these teams have not been implemented properly.
Hmm.
So it's meant to be made up of a group of faculty members and teachers at a school that are trained to identify any problems with student behavior, signs of violence, any warning signs. And then they take those concerns to level one and level two assessments, which include referring them to mental health services and having law enforcement address these students.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that the commission found that these teams are not properly trained and they're not consistent across schools and school districts is a big part of their recommendations to say, hey, legislature, we need something that mandates that this is an even, well-trained process at every Florida school.
Mm-hmm. A comment here from one of our listeners, an ordinary girl, who writes, one facet of school safety is teaching parents, teachers, and children how to effectively and respectfully express negative emotions. Mindfulness-based social-emotional learning programs are the solution to meeting the need of teaching children how to manage these emotions. So getting to the kind of mental health part of the equation there. Zach Hudson, I want to just bring you back into this conversation for a moment and sort of the idea of trying to get every school in the state on the same page when it comes to training, whether it's how teachers and staff respond or whether it's school hardening or anything else like that. I mean, how do you, as somebody who's, working on as a private security consultant, make sure that you are kind of in line with what this act says should be happening at every school?
Yeah, there's no real easy answer to that because there's so many different opinions. You have a lot of folks out there that think that you should do this or someone else should do that, and who's responsible for paying for all of this. You talk about mental health screenings and having this team in place. Who trains? Where is that training coming from? Where is that education coming from for these administrators to get this training? It's great to come up with an idea, but at the end of the day, you have to be able to implement that.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that you actually have to have a real curriculum to actually look at to determine if you can train people to assess someone that might be a killer.
Mm-hmm. Sheriff Leamer, if I could bring you back as well, just listening to our comment or the question from our caller, Eric, about why something wasn't done sooner, that sort of goes to your point a little bit about what school resource officers and others can do to identify a threat or sort of try and step in and intervene if they can see some warning signs. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that the law enforcement agency providing primary service to those campuses absolutely have to have a relationship with the school superintendent and the school principals. This kind of notion of schools not wanting to report certain type of activity or behaviors because it's going to make the campus look negative, or they have to worry about a scoring card on discipline or educational advancement.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that cannot go on. We have a very unique relationship here in Seminole County, and actually many of the counties are now starting to mirror what we have, but our school superintendent has worked so well with us over the years that he allowed us to put a dedicated captain of the sheriff's office as his director of school safety and security, and quite literally works out of his office. And he entrusts this sheriff's captain to make all decisions relating to security, hardening campuses, how the budget is spent. And I can't stress enough how important it is for those sheriffs and those superintendents to come together. In some areas, it just doesn't happen. There's conversations of lawsuits going back and forth. But
right.
But when it comes to school safety and security, that is paramount. And we need dedicated, trained professionals making those calls and giving those recommendations.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you, too, just about one other thing. Sheriff Leamer, and the idea of training for these things, of course, last month, like Brantley High School had an unannounced Code Red drill, which kind of alarmed some students and parents. I'm wondering if there's anything in this report or just if you can share anything on what the sheriff's office might be doing differently to make sure training is done, but it's done in a way that doesn't kind of freak people out.
Yeah, so we're doing unannounced drills and announced drills. The unannounced drills are drills where we would walk into the campus and tell everybody at the time, we're moving into our Code Red drill right now.
Mm-hmm.
But there's never a perception that there's an active threat on campus. You know, when you look at what happened at Lake Brantley High School, we had conducted hundreds of those same drills mm-hmm. without any incidents. Anytime you're on a campus or you're actually any environment that has thousands of people, the only thing you need is three people running in a direction saying shooter,
right?
And you're going to have chaos on your hands.
Right.
So I think when you look at what happened at Lake Brantley, it bothered me and it bothered our leadership team, both on the school board side and the sheriff's office side, tremendously, because the last thing we want to do is to unintentionally traumatize children, faculty, staff members, or their parents. But at the same time, we need to make sure that people are equipped and prepared.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that we still face is, if people perceive that there's a real and imminent threat, there's going to be a problem. We had a situation, actually the Orange County jurisdiction had a situation mm-hmm. in the Florida Mall.
Right. Over the weekend,
and
yeah.
So it was a similar situation. So this happened at the school lunch. So we've redesigned our drills to make sure that there are no confusions about the active threat assessment.
Mm-hmm.
We also partner with Mutual Link for their Rave Panic app.
Mm-hmm.
And we have been working with them to modify that because one of the categories that's listed there is active shooter.
Mm-hmm.
And it may not be an active shooter. It may just be an active threat.
Well, Sheriff Dennis Lima, we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you so much for joining us. Seminole County Sheriff Dennis Lima, appreciate you being with us. Also joined by security expert Zach Hudson and WLRN's Katie Sotelski talking about the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Public High School Safety Commission and their report, which is on its way to the folks in Tallahassee right now. Up next on Intersection, unpacking the UCF Knights' loss to the LSU Tigers and what their historic winning run means for college football. Intersection is back with a minute. Back in a minute, rather. Stay with us. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The LSU Tigers brought UCF's two-year winning streak to an end at the Fiesta Bowl on New Year's Day. Jeff Sharon is the editor of the Black and Gold Banneret and a UCF grad himself. He joined us to dissect the Knights' loss and what their winning run says about college football.
745 days between losses. The Knights' last loss was in December of 2016 during the Obama administration, if you can believe it, in Camping World Stadium at the AutoNation Cure Bowl against Arkansas State. 25 wins in a row is really a magical number. Since the Division I split, when they split Division I of football between FCS and FBS, used to be called Division I-A and Division I-AA, only, I believe, six of the 130 teams have had a winning streak as long as that. The longest since then is 34. That was the University of Miami Hurricanes in the early 2000s, won 34 straight games, and also the USC Trojans in the mid-2000s, although USC had the bulk of their wins wiped out due to a scandal and NCAA sanctions. But, I mean, the game still happened. We watched them happen. So if you look at the record book, you'll only see Miami up there at 34. Well, a few spots below that's UCF at 25, which is – when you look back at it, it's truly remarkable what this team has been able to do under two different head coaches with two completely different coaching staffs 2 years after going 0-12. I don't think that the sting of the loss to LSU is still raw. But I think when UCF fans kind of have the benefit of a little bit of time, they'll look back on it and say, this is truly remarkable what UCF has done.
Let's talk a little bit about Mackenzie Milton. He was watching the game, so a morale booster for the team to have him in the stands. But he's gone through a bunch of surgeries. I mean, his leg's still in pretty bad shape. What's his future looking like?
So it's hard to say right now. He has another operation scheduled for the end of January that his mother actually described on social media. That's going to be for his nervous system. In his legs, he's going through a lot of tests, a lot of rehab in that, and it's his fifth operation on the knee in the last, since the day after Thanksgiving when he was rushed into the emergency room at Tampa General, and yet at the Fiesta Bowl in Arizona, when asked by members of the media whether they thought, what the status of Mackenzie Milton was, both head coach Josh Heupel and quarterback coach Jeff Lebby, who worked obviously very closely with Milton throughout the year, refused to rule out the possibility that he would be back for the 2019 season. Now, that doesn't mean he will be back. However, it was interesting to note that they were like, we're just taking it one day at a time. We'll see how it goes. Now, Mackenzie is 22 years old. College athlete in excellent shape. If anyone can come back to any extent to play again from an injury that devastating, he certainly can.
Well, critics of the Knights say their 25 win record came only because the team wasn't playing enough opponents of high enough quality outside their lower ranked athletic conference. Were the Tigers a worthy challenger?
Certainly. The LSU coming out of the SEC, they play in the SEC West, which is the same side of the SEC as Alabama and as Auburn. LSU plays Florida on a yearly basis. They're one of the top programs, not just recently, but historically. And even though they lost to Alabama 29-0 in their game between those two earlier this year. LSU's still a very good top-level team. Now, in terms of the argument against UCF and the American Athletic Conference, yes, there's no doubt that if you were to stack up the entirety of the American Athletic Conference against, say, the entirety of the SEC or the ACC or the Big Ten, there's a gap there. However, the college football world, if there's one thing that UCF has proven, is a lot flatter than people in the SEC, ACC, Big Ten, the so-called Power Five conferences, want you to believe. Yeah, there is a gap there, but it's not as much as people think.
Mm-hmm. So what's at stake? I mean, what would be the harm in allowing UCF to break into that next level?
Well, I don't think there would be any harm to it. But the issue that we have here is that with the teams in the or schools rather in this group of five, sort of unofficial delineation, you effectively have half of the football bowl subdivision is in limbo. The UCF has gone undefeated now and won a conference championship two consecutive years and weren't even remotely seriously considered for entry into the college football playoff, the four-team playoff, which Alabama and Clemson are currently left standing in to play the championship game. So the 65 teams, including UCF, USF, and all those other teams in the group of five conferences, they're in this limbo where the college football playoff committee, who decides who plays in that 14 playoff, is not going to let them in because they're going to say, well, their schedule strength isn't all that great.
Mm-hmm.
However, they can't drop down to the FCS level where, for example, Stetson plays, where they have a full 24-team playoff where all conference champions are invited plus some at-large teams. So they can't drop down to that level to have a chance at a national championship. They can't break into the national championship at FBS. So one thing that Danny White, the athletic director of UCF, has been ringing the bell for over the past year is, why do we think that this system is okay? It's not. I have a team here that's won 25 consecutive games, mm-hmm. beaten a few FBS Power 5 teams along the way, at Maryland last year, Auburn in the bowl game last year. They defeated Pitt, who lost to Clemson in the ACC championship game, and beat them by 31 points as well. And yet we're somehow not good enough? When will we be good enough? What do we have to do? We're not going to get invited into one of the Power 5 conferences just yet. So what do we and the rest of the 65 teams have to do? We've kind of broken the system here,
mm-hmm.
or at least the system was broken. We've just proved that.
And are there other teams like UCF that are knocking on the door and saying, let us into this college football playoff?
Certainly. Boise State has been very good over the past, really, 15 years. They used to be called a BCS buster when we had the old bowl championship series. They've proven themselves to be very worthy competition against Power 5 competition. Fresno State has been very good. We've seen Nevada do this. We've seen a number of teams actually have a shot at breaking in, but they just can't get through that glass ceiling. And I think that's part of the frustration of it is, like, if not us and if not now, who and when?
And how long do you see this playing out? Where do you see this going from here?
Well, the contract for the college football playoff lasts until about 2026. That's it's sort of two cycles between all the bowl games to host the semifinals. Okay, now, and that's also the television contract with ESPN and Disney. It is largely thought that there would be at least the possibility of expanding the playoff field to perhaps eight or maybe even more. We don't know. Once that contract comes to an end. However, there have been some grumblings in the last month from some of the folks involved in the college football playoff committee, notably Barry Alvarez, the longtime former head coach at the University of Wisconsin, and a couple of other people, that, you know, something, maybe we do need to actually expand this thing to eight at some point. The sponsorship of the college football playoff, that contract ends after 2020. So there's certainly a non-zero possibility that ESPN and the major conferences, by the way, who effectively own the company that runs the college football playoff, could get into a room, tear up the contract, renegotiate a new one, and say, okay, we're going to have eight teams, and we're going to guarantee one spot to the highest-ranked conference champion from the group of five conferences. But there's also no guarantee that that would happen. And I think that's what UCF is fighting for, is you have to try and include us in it, because the way this is working out, we have no way of actually seeing if how we stack up on that national level. Now, I personally favor a 16-team playoff where all conference champions are invited, but that's just my personal preference. You know, that and 79 cents will get you a box of grape juice. But I do hope, and I think a lot of UCF fans also hope, that with the next negotiation, teams like UCF, like USF, like Florida Atlantic and Florida International will get a chance actually to play on the level with the, quote, big boys, end quote. It's funny how they use that terminology and refer to UCF as a small school when actually by enrollment, UCF is larger than all of them.
Jeff Sharon is the managing editor of the Black and Gold Banneret. Thank you so much, Jeff.
Matthew, thank you so much. It's always good to be with you.
Still to come on Intersection, Scottish fiddle player Cameron Ross has been honing his craft at Raglan Road Pub at Disney Springs for the past 2 years. Now Ross is a finalist for BBC Radio Scotland's Young Traditional Musician of the Year Award. So how's he feeling about it?
Very nervous. Very, yeah, having nightmares and things.
Cameron Ross and the Raglan Roots Coalition join us when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Fiddle player Cameron Ross is a finalist for the BBC Radio Scotland Young Traditional Musician of the Year competition. For the last couple of years, Ross, who's from Scotland, has been playing with the Raglan Roots Coalition Band at Raglan Road Irish Pub at Disney Springs. We caught up with Ross and the band before he flies out for the competition. Here they are with a song called Banish Misfortune. Thank you. listening to Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. And that was the Raglan Roots Coalition with a track called Banish Misfortune. The band are Cameron Ross on fiddle, Emily Furlong on banjitar, Keelan Kelly on bass, Ben Rowe on snare cajon, and Blaine Curtis on guitar. Fiddle player Cameron Ross is leaving the band. He's heading back to Scotland to compete in BBC Radio Scotland's Young Traditional Musician of the Year. Here's Ross with a tune called Leaving St Kilda. Cameron Ross, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also joined by Kieron Keating, production manager at Raglan Road. Thank you so much for joining us as well.
Thank you.
So I want to start with you, Cameron. Is this your first go-round at this competition?
It is, yes. Got through to the semi-finals, which were in October, and now on to the finals in January, so looking forward to it.
How big a deal is it?
It's a huge deal for me. I've been wanting to do it for many years, and I'm glad to finally have made it through.
You don't just play the fiddle, though, right? You've got a bunch of different instruments up your sleeve. Why choose the fiddle?
I think the fiddle's what I've been playing the longest, and I try to play that the best. the other things are just for fun mostly, but enjoy the fiddle the most.
But some of the competition, I think the other musicians you're up against are playing guitar, flute, bagpipes. There's vocalists as well. Yeah. It must be a bit tough to sort of put yourself against them and think, how am I going to outshine them when it's a completely different instrument?
So I think that's what I'm worried about at the moment, trying to just do my best against the variety that there is.
Well, let me bring you into this conversation, Kieron. How do you go about finding your musicians?
We advertise mainly on social media, but then word of mouth. We have such a good reputation for the entertainment that we put on and we provide for all of the young talent that's coming up at the moment. So a bit of variety between all of it, but we do video auditions and then we do personal auditions as well back home in Ireland. But our talent ranges from UK and Ireland mainly.
Do you get some musicians from the US or from other countries as well performing there?
Yes, we have. Recently, our new fiddle player will be taking over from Cameron. She's from Canada. So her name's Ellen. So she's joining the cast with us.
So there's a pretty strong tradition of that kind of music in Canada and the United States and elsewhere as well?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it's worldwide at this stage now, yeah. Mm-hmm. Ellen has travelled over to Ireland to compete in the Irish FLA at home as well and done quite well.
So Cameron, once you head off to this competition, are you coming back to Raglan Road or is this it for you?
No, as of just now, that's me. I've been on and off at Raglan for 2 years now.
Mm-hmm.
So, going off to do other things for the time being anyway.
He'll be back. We'll have him back. Yeah, he never leaves. When you join Raglan and you're part of the family, you always come back.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so how did you get into this form of music? Is this something you've grown up playing?
Yeah, I think obviously I had a lot of support from my family and things, and was I went to a music school back home that was traditional music and university studied Scottish music, and also actually in Tennessee I studied bluegrass and old time music, so that kind of intertwined with my sort of Celtic style and things, and just always had a passion for it, and just could never stop playing. So
have you been able to pick up some new things or some different ideas from the Appalachian tradition of music here since you've been in the US?
I really enjoyed researching that, just a lot of the Scottish-Irish, you know, travellers and travelled over to the Appalachians, and just as well as the music, I think that the history plays a lot of the part for getting the music where it is. So yeah, just really enjoyed learning about that and how that's affected the music and song and culture. So
the competition you're in, the BBC Radio Scotland Young Traditional Musician of the Year. I mean, how popular is this kind of music with young musicians? Is there some kind of resurgence going on?
I think so. Yeah, I think it's become fashionable since I was growing up. It's definitely amongst the young players. It's really become popular and between Scotland and Ireland, definitely.
If you win, what does that mean?
So I think there's there's a few things that the winner gets I think some sort of recording package with the BBC and a list of sort of good performing opportunities. I think the latest winner was playing at the Proms down in London. So just a lot of good opportunities and musicians' union membership and things. So great exposure, though. Just really glad to be part of the competition for that.
Kieran, I want to ask about your other field of interest, which is Irish dancing.
Yes.
I understand you're an award-winning dancer.
Yep, champion.
Do you get to showcase some of that at the pub as well?
Yeah, we have a lot of our Irish dancers are Ireland, UK, and we have some US dancers as well. But I don't dance on a nightly basis, but I overlook everything, and we're constantly changing the choreography. Mm-hmm. We have a new number being introduced in the next 2 weeks as well, so there's a lot of work evolving around the Irish dancing part of it.
How fit do you have to be really good?
Yeah, you're kind of, well, working in Raglan, because we have such, our entertainment starts from 4 every day and it goes right through till 2 a.m. at night. Our dancing finishes up at around 10 every day, so that in itself is a lot of dancing for one particular dancer, so that's their workout every day.
Mm-hmm. Finally, Cameron, a few more questions for you about the competition. Are you nervous at all?
Very nervous. Very, yeah, I've been having nightmares and things. I'm actually flying back from Jamaica for a couple of days and then flying back out, so it's quite a big deal. No pressure.
Is there some kind of routine you go through before performing to get your mind in the right place?
Normally I have a few glasses of whiskey. Just no, I don't. I used to, but I don't do that anymore. It's yeah, I don't think that's as helpful as I used to think. But
what about the judges?
Yeah,
do they drink as they're listening?
I don't know. It's actually quite anonymous. I'm not really sure who the judges are. I don't think you normally find out or anything, so
really
who knows.
So you're just playing it and you don't know who's out there?
No, they're somewhere in the audience, I believe, but I don't know exactly where, so they'll be somewhere. But yeah, looking forward to it. Should be fun.
Well, Cameron Ross, best of luck to you, and congratulations on making this far.
Thank you, appreciate it.
And thank you also, Kieran Keating.
Yes, no problem. Anytime you're around, pop in and say hello.
And to take us out, Cameron Ross and the Raglan Roots Coalition with a track called The Tsar of Munster. Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Production assistance for this week's show from Emily Lang, Danielle Pryor and Juan Gualder. Find us on the NPR One app, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.